You're listening to The Takeaway Podcast. Look for us on Twitter and Facebook by searching for The Takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. We will begin this hour on a note of revenge and political vendetta in North Korea that has ended in death, a death that could set in motion more turmoil on the Korean Peninsula. We will end on a note of kindness, though, and consider the year that has passed since the shooting tragedy in Newtown, Connecticut. Along the way, some revelations about the consequences of a farm bill, shall we say, bound up on Capitol Hill, and who that is affecting. We'll definitely hear some voices there. But we begin in North Korea, where it is not clear whether the citizens of that country are relieved or alarmed by this report. Dramatic reading there of the official announcement that Jong Song-taek has been executed, the audio courtesy of North Korea's KRT TV. North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un first purged his uncle as an advisor. We learned that last week. Earlier this week, dramatic pictures of him being dragged from a political meeting by military police were released to the world. Now the announcement that he has been tried, convicted, and executed for treason. What does it all mean? How might the North Koreans be receiving this news? Joining us now from Seoul, South Korea, is Sokil Park, Director of Research and Strategy for the refugee advocacy group Liberty in North Korea. Sokil Park, welcome.
Thank you.
So, first of all, the execution, the significance. Is this a political purge with wider implications for the region, or is this a battle over money between an uncle and a nephew?
Well, at the moment, the regional implications are not clear. I think that the most important effects are going to be domestic. And so right now, the most interesting thing actually about this is not the execution itself, because North Korea has had purges, you know, going right back to the start of the foundation of the country under Kim Il-sung. But the really interesting thing here is how sensationally publicized they've made this. So they've had North Korean state media revelations of Jang Song-taek's alleged crimes that have been very strong and very lengthy. And they've also released the pictures of Jang Song-taek being arrested at this meeting, as you mentioned, and also on trial, at this military trial, and then saying that he's going to be executed. And so at the moment, it seems that this message is really designed to show the people, everybody in the country, and also people in the outside world, that Kim Jong-un is really in charge, that he has absolute power and power is centralized underneath him. But the really interesting thing is that if you read between the lines of this message, it appears that that may not actually be the case. It appears that actually there may be more factional infighting and more weakness and division at the top level of the regime.
Well, let's do some between the lines reading if we can. I want to give people a feel for just the rhetoric here. Here's some of that statement that was heard by North Koreans today. From long ago, Jang had a dirty political ambition. He dare not raise his head when Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il were alive. But reading their faces, Jang had an axe to grind and involved himself in double dealing. The accused is a traitor to the nation for all ages who perpetrated anti-party counter-revolutionary factional acts. And this one, however, despicable human scum Jang, who was worse than a dog, perpetrated thrice-cursed acts of treachery in betrayal of such profound trust and warmest paternal love shown by the party and the leader for him. Can you decipher any of that for me?
Well, I mean, there's really a lot in there. And I think that the KCNA, the North Korean state media announcement today, was actually 2,700 words long. This was really an essay where they put anything and everything that they could put on Jang Song-taek. So, you know, they criticized him for corruption, for trying to sow division, trying to even instigate a coup against Kim Jong-un. And so it seems that, you know, they really went to town on this PR job and this criticism of Jang Song-taek. Maybe they felt that they had to do that because he had risen so high and his own personal power base was so deep that when they, you know, brought him down and when they were purging him, they had to do it in such a dramatic and such a total way. But one of the really interesting things about this, these statements, I think, is that it's kind of opened this window to the level of elite politics in Pyongyang, and it's a very rare window. You know, the North Korean regime has spent a lot of time, you know, decades on trying to curate this image of the North Korean regime, which is very united, which is pure, which is infallible. And all of a sudden, they've opened this window to this picture, which is a very ugly picture, which features highest level corruption, factionalism, and even blaming parts of the regime for their economic failures, which they've traditionally blamed on, you know, American-led sanctions or even the weather. This is an implicit kind of recognition that there's division and weakness within the regime. So this is to the outside world. But maybe even more significant is that this message has gone to the North Korean people themselves that can now think about the North Korean government in a different way.
Well, there are many reports in South Korea suggesting this is an argument over bank accounts between the uncle and the nephew. And we'll have to see if this reflects a personal style of Kim Jong-un. Sohil Park, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Sohil Park is Director of Research and Strategy for the advocacy group Liberty in North Korea. We move now to a fairly mind-blowing example of CIA overreach that doesn't come from Edward Snowden's leaks and probably is too outlandish even for the writers of Homeland, except this one is apparently true, according to the Associated Press and the Washington Post. Robert Levinson, a former FBI agent who disappeared in Iran more than 6 years ago, a man who has been presumed to be a hostage of some kind, a designation that the U.S. government has not taken issue with, it turns out Levinson may be a casualty of a CIA operation gone bad. Analysts, acting on their own, sent Levinson into Iran in an operation that apparently blew up and involved the reported payment of CIA money to the Levinson family and eventually caused a purge within the CIA, all without producing any intelligence or information about the whereabouts or fate of Mr. Levinson. Tim Weiner joins us now, author of the acclaimed CIA history, Legacy of Ashes. Tim, welcome to the program.
Thanks, John.
What do you make of these Levinson revelations here?
Well, assuming this story is 100% true and the track record of the two reporters is extremely good, this is a case of extreme carelessness in pursuit of human intelligence, and it is a case of human error without real parallel in the history of the CIA.
And without parallel in the sense that it went bad, or without parallel in the sense, I mean, the detail that really stands out to me is that analysts were running their own actual operation here.
That's right. That's like telling your defensive team to play offense. They're not equipped to do that. They're not trained to do that. It's freelancing, and that's bad news in a secret intelligence organization.
Well, even more, it's more like having Bob Costas be the quarterback, not the defense offense. These people aren't used to taking the field at all. What would be the possible motivation for analysts to try something like this?
Glory, promotion, status. It is not the kind of operating environment, Iran, a hostile, denied territory for spies, where you can wing an operation like this. And, you know, the only parallel I can think of is back in the Reagan administration when a hotshot lieutenant colonel on the National Security Council staff named Ollie North thought it would be a good idea to sell anti-tank missiles to the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. It was not a good idea. And this operation was clearly not a good idea either.
Very interesting. That's an interesting echo of the Iran-Contra affair. The payments, the alleged payments to Levinson's wife, Christine, first of all, is there precedent for those? And clearly the CIA understood that this was kind of DEFCON 5, that it was a five-alarm fire here.
Well, it sounds like hush money. I mean, and it sounds like there was guilty knowledge within the CIA, if indeed three veteran analyst officers were forced out and seven others were disciplined. You have to screw up pretty badly to get forced out of the agency. You really have to commit stupidity on a felonious scale.
And Levinson disappeared more than 6 years ago. All of this has transpired behind the scenes. Levinson, of course, who knew everything here, Can you imagine just the futility he must be feeling, I mean, and has felt for pretty much this entire period of time?
You know, there are two reasons for keeping deep secrets in government. There are legitimate secrets in government. The names of covert foreign agents, the mechanics for making a bomb. But, you know, too often secrecy is used to cover up embarrassing mistakes. And there are very few secrets the time will not reveal. And the longer you keep a secret for reasons of embarrassment, the worse it looks.
The official line from the government at one time was that Mr. Levinson was not working for the United States government at the time of his disappearance. He, of course, is ex-FBI, but now the National Security Council has declined to comment on any ties Levinson has to the U.S. government. The investigation into the disappearance continues. We all remain committed to finding him and bringing him home safely to his family. That's from National Security Council spokeswoman Caitlin Hayden. How does Levinson now figure into the new potential rapprochement or new sense of openness between the U.S. and Iran on the nuclear issue? Is he a pawn, or is he just tossed in the dustbin because he really is now CIA?
Well, you're speaking of him in the present tense. You know, if he's alive, that's one thing. And if he's disappeared, or if he's in a grave, that's quite another. I don't see where the bargaining power is of a you know, rogue freelance operative working under dubious jurisdiction for the Department of Analytical Intelligence at CIA comes into the play of geopolitics at this point.
Do you think these revelations push the momentum for us to maybe eventually know more about this, or will this just add to the mystery and the sense of we may never get closure here?
Yeah, it's hard to know less about a case of disappearance like this. There are obviously people at CIA, past and present, that have something to answer for in this. Whether they ever will do so, I wouldn't put a lot of money on it. And, you know, the poor guy was looking for adventure, right? He got a lot more than he bargained for.
Tim Weiner is author of the acclaimed CIA history, Legacy of Ashes. He describes this Levinson case as yet another case of carelessness at a cost of human life in the name of human intelligence. Tim Weiner, thanks so much.
You bet.
Later this hour, the evolving, changing, healing, but never reversible process of grieving, national and personal. We'll talk about the call from Newtown families for an act of kindness from all Americans in remembrance of their losses. What could be the meaning and power in an unexpected act of kindness?
One day, I was riding public transportation in the Dominican Republic, and the driver did not announce that he was going to change his route. So now I was going to have to walk like 7 miles to get to my house. And at that exact moment, just like magic, this lady next to me looked into her purse and she gave me $2. That act of kindness changed my life, and I will never forget.
More on Newtown and acts of kindness and the process of grieving later this hour here on The Takeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Tomorrow marks the somber one-year anniversary of the horrible shooting at the Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut.
We'll be thinking of Aviel and where she would have been at 7 instead of at 6, and hopefully what we could do to prevent somebody else from feeling that same sadness.
More than 20 little children lost their lives when a vengeful, mentally unstable man entered the school, heavily armed, and began shooting, eventually killing himself. That man speaking there is Jeremy Richmond, father of one of the victims. Together, the victim families have asked that in remembrance of the tragedy, all Americans perform an act of kindness. We'll have more to say about that later in the program, as well as look at how the gun industry and the gun lobby and gun laws have all responded to this tragedy in surprising ways. But perhaps the starkest and most irreversible change from the Sandy Hook tragedy is the assumption now, the terrible assumption that elementary schools, with their playgrounds and little backpack-carrying bright-eyed children learning to read and count can all of a sudden be a target of a gunman acting out like some SWAT team in the middle of school. Lindsay Jarek-Harris joins us now, fourth-grade teacher right here in New York City. Welcome.
Thank you.
You know, we get to talk to thousands of elementary school teachers, but in many ways, you're no different than any of the schools in America that have had to consider suddenly this Newtown scenario. Take us back to the days afterwards. How did you respond? How did you feel about your own school, just looking around at the students, that sort of thing?
My goal in my classroom and as a teacher is to ensure that my students are comfortable in their environment and aware of their environment. And in addition to that awareness, I want them to be self-aware and realize that it's important for them to know that they have an effect on their environment. So, you know, when I know that we were going to have to start implementing emergency procedures in our school, so, you know, I stress to them that in an extraordinary event, this is what we have to do to stay safe. Mm-hmm. And it's not likely that this will happen in our school, but it's important to be prepared.
Can you take me back to that first drill that you had to practice and what that was like and how you felt about that and your concerns? And
yeah, like I said, I try to keep it as light as possible with the children without trying to scare them too much, because what we have to do in our classroom is every window that has to be covered. So our door has a window on it. So now I have a shade that I have to pull down. And what happens is when we had our first lockdown, I explained to the children, you know, this is what we need to prepare for. And, you know, they understood, but they were scared. They were very scared. And, you know, is this going to happen to us? You know, and you have to be prepared to answer those questions. And the first time we did it, the kids were amazing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I said to them, this is what we need to do in a situation like this. We don't know where we're going to be or how, you know, everyone's going to react. But the way you reacted today is the way it should be. And, you know, with the kids have to, what I have to do as a teacher is make sure that no one's in the hallway. And I have to lock my door, and then the children quickly move out of sight of the doorway and crowd. All 30 students have to crowd in the corner of the classroom, and we have to wait until either a responder comes to my door, or in this case, since it's a drill,
is it all clear?
Yeah, an all clear. Exactly. Yeah, the administrator comes and
I can see
react.
On your face you've thought it through.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. Definitely.
As a teacher, what an incomprehensible process that must have been over the past year.
Mm-hmm.
Changes your whole environment.
Yeah. I mean, you look at, and it's sad to say, but you look at everyone differently that comes into the school now.
Really?
I do. And I know that my colleagues, we talk about it. You know, if you see a person that you've never seen before come into the school, you have your suspicions. You know, who is that? Why are they here? And, you know, you never thought that before.
Somebody carrying brownies for the...
Yeah.
Could be... Oh,
exactly,
my God.
Exactly. So you just never know now. And you always have to kind of put up your guard and say, okay, I can't be naive. I have to make sure I know who this person is or why they're here.
Do the kids want to know who the bad people are, where they come from, why?
Yeah, they talked about 9/11 a lot. Yeah, 9/11 came up, and they kind of related Adam Lanza to the terrorist attacks of 9/11. And, you know, I had to explain that, you know, sometimes people are mentally ill, and you know, unfortunate things like this do happen. And this is why we prepare for these tragedies, mm-hmm. for these events.
Mm-hmm. How about your job as a teacher? Has that changed?
No, I try to not let it dictate the culture of the school. I don't want this fear to dictate the culture. And like I said, my goal is to make sure that my students are comfortable in their environment, in my classroom. So I try to keep that fear away unless it's presented to me from a child. And it hasn't so far this year. So Yeah, it hasn't been an issue.
But it does sound like part of your responsibility as a teacher this year, unlike last year, mm-hmm. unlike anything you'd really ever contemplated, mm-hmm. is this fight to prevent this sense of vigilance from mm-hmm. taking over the school, taking mm-hmm. over the culture of this elementary school.
Yeah, I am definitely more aware of the whereabouts of my students now, whether they're going down to the nurse or taking down the attendance for the day. I have a log of when they're out of the classroom, they're in the bathroom, or when they see a service provider. So that's definitely something that I guess has changed as well for me. I need to know where they are at all times to make sure if anything were to happen, you know, I know that they're safe.
Who's braver, the teachers or the kids? Or is that even an appropriate question?
I don't know. I would like to say I'm braver, but I know that my kids are very strong. And I think that in a situation, if a situation were to occur, we'd all work together.
A beautiful thought, a sad thought, a year after mm-hmm. Sandy Hook. Lindsay Jerakaris, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Lindsay Jerakaris is a fourth grade teacher in New York City.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
Another of the irreversible consequences of the Newtown tragedy has taken place in the gun industry itself. Pre-Newtown, annual gun sales hovered around 9 million, but in the first 11 months of this year, the year since Newtown, sales are estimated at 19 million. The New York Times and others looking at gun laws have found that about 1,500 state gun bills were introduced since the shooting. 109 of those became law. Two-thirds of those new laws actually loosened gun restrictions, though, while the other third made them tighter. Robert Draper is contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, where this week he writes about the legislative battle over gun control since Newtown. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, John.
So the dynamics here are really setting a relatively passive pro-gun control population that may be numerically superior to the gun owners, but the gun owners are a passionate, very politically active group, and that's what's played out over the last year.
I think that's right. I think that what we're seeing is a gap in intensity between, I guess, what you would call Second Amendment absolutists, people who don't want to see any changes at all in existing gun regulations, and those who do. The latter, as you say, may constitute greater numbers, but they're not single-issue voters, and there has never yet been a case where any legislator has felt electoral wrath for not passing more gun laws. It's always been the opposite case.
And that played out this year specifically. Let's look at the case in Colorado.
Colorado is the obvious case in point. In 2012, a very tough series of gun restrictions were passed and signed by the Democratic governor, John Hickenlooper. This year, however, a recall effort was successfully underway for two of the state senators who were key figures in the passage of that bill, and a third state senator resigned under a threat of a recall. So if there has been anything along the lines of a chilling effect vis-a-vis gun violence laws, that certainly is the case in point episode.
So two-thirds of the new laws loosened gun restrictions. What kind of loosening are we talking about?
In some cases, they'll allow a shorter window. If, for example, you cannot find anything wrong in a person's background within a 24-hour period, you have to sell them a gun. There are some that exempt certain individuals from having to submit to background checks. There are others as well that allow people who, say, are veterans, have had some mental issues that have allowed them to buy guns where before they weren't able to do so. It's a very, very mixed bag, and there are some states on the that have passed more gun restrictions and loosened existing restrictions at the same time.
What about the increased restrictions? What form have they typically taken?
The increased restrictions are typically the kinds of guns that can be purchased, the kinds of magazine clips, the capacity of them. That's the case in Colorado as well. And the actual extension of background checks to cover, say, internet purchases and gun shows.
There was a lot of discussion that in the wake of Newtown, in fact, some of the responses would be to extend the use of guns as a defensive measure inside places like elementary schools. How has that played out?
In a couple of states, that has actually been under legislative consideration. But Wayne LaPierre, the executive director of the NRA, is who you're referring to, who gave that famous speech in the wake of Newtown saying the only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. And you know what he was pitching was having armed security at every school. There are a number of people who are, in fact, in support of that. But it was not part of the legislative package that ultimately was recommended by the White House, and it never had serious consideration on Capitol Hill.
The pattern of gun restrictions versus the loosening of restrictions that you've observed over the past year, a surprise to you or pretty much as you would have expected?
It hasn't been a surprise because you have to sort of look state by state. I mean, Colorado, for example, the table was very much set for legislative remedies. This was where an awful tragedy had occurred, two of them really, in Columbine and then in Aurora. You had Democrats in the, controlling the legislature as well as in the state house. In other states, it hasn't been as hospitable. That's why, you know, on a federal level, because Republicans tend to be more averse to gun legislation and the fact that they control the House of Representatives, you haven't seen any movement.
Robert Draper, contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. He writes about the legislative battle over gun control since the Newtown tragedy. Robert, thanks so much.
It's my pleasure.
Dad, are any of these movies good?
Worst episode ever.
I see a lot of films. I love all of them.
Your job is to rate movies on a scale from good to excellent.
Hated it.
Movie time on this Friday the 13th. Oh, my goodness. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, co-host of the Movie Date podcast with Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway. Welcome, guys.
Hi, John.
So I've got a question for you. How do I pronounce this? The Hobbit, The Desolation of Smaug?
Smaug.
Smaug?
Not like the pollution. It's like Smaug.
That's our first offering this weekend. Listen.
You've changed, Rupert Baggins. You're not the same hobbit as the one who left the Shire.
I was going to tell you. I found something in the goblin tunnels.
Found what?
My courage.
Yes, the ponderous pacing there of another Lord of the Rings movie. You're not the same hobbit, Ian McKellen says to Martin Friedman. But Rafer, is this the same movie magic in this installment of The Hobbit?
I did not find it quite as magical as the first episode, or perhaps maybe a little too magical. It's a lot of orcs, a lot of elves, a lot of battle after battle after battle, and a lot of talking. And I found it just a hair less entertaining than the first Hobbit.
And Kristen?
Well, as you know, John, I did not like the first Hobbit. I don't think that there needs to be three Hobbit movies. This is a children's book that's being turned into a 9-hour saga. And this middle movie, really, you can feel that they're stretching it out. Walking, being captured, walking, being accosted, walking and fighting, and lots of exposition. Feels like a really terrible middle movie that doesn't need to be part of the equation.
So it's the Nelson Mandela biopic version of the Hobbit,
right?
Yeah, it's sort of just relentlessly detailed.
So yes. Many details.
But if you just sort of relax and try to escape, can you, or does it eventually catch up with you?
Yeah, if you take a nice nap during it, it's a wonderful escape.
I can make neither head nor tails of the trailer for this next movie, Saving Mr. Banks. Let's hear a clip.
What are you doing?
All right, here we go.
Room here for everyone. Gather around.
The constable's responsible.
Now, how does that sound?
No. Responsible is not a word.
We made it up.
Well, unmake it up.
Now that's the ensemble of Emma Thompson, Jason Schwartzman, and BJ Novak in a scene from a movie about Walt Disney trying to get the rights to Mary Poppins, Rafer?
That's right. It takes place in 1961. That's P.L. Travers. She's the author of the book, Mary Poppins. Walt Disney, played by Tom Hanks, has been trying to get her to make the movie for 20 years. She finally decides to come out to California, sit down with him, talk turkey. But she's very resistant. And I think what puzzles you, John, is the title of the movie, which refers to the father in the Mary Poppins books, George Banks. There's a lot of psychological connection between her own father, played by Colin Farrell, in flashback, and between the George Banks character, which I don't feel like the movie ever quite makes clear enough, but it's still a pretty interesting backstory about the making of this movie.
Hanks playing Disney. Is this a piece of Americana that is wondrous and fabulous, or?
There is not a better person to play Walt Disney in this world than Tom Hanks.
He's I would agree.
Absolutely perfect Walt Disney. And Emma Thompson, I think her acting is spectacular in this. She's playing a real curmudgeon who's very bitter and can't let go of the past, and that can be really hard to watch a character for 2 hours like that. But there's something so delightful about her the whole time. You're kind of laughing when she's insulting people and putting them down. And I would have to disagree, by the way, with Rafer, who says that you never quite get to the nugget of what's going on here with Mr. Banks. I think you get to it too much.
All right.
That being said, I really enjoyed this movie.
And the podcast this week?
This week, we are talking about the Golden Globe nominations.
All right, which are very serious this year, I understand. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, co-host of the Movie Date podcast with Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway. Thanks, guys. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, John.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. So, Gary Kamak, you out there?
Yes, I am.
You're waiting on the farm bill, is that right?
That would be correct. We've gone through quite a fall and winter. It's not officially winter yet, but it's already been a long winter.
And how many cows did you lose because of the weather over the last 12 months?
On our own ranch here, we lost more than 100 head, and that represented about 20% of our herd. And it was quite a loss for our ranch. But the truth is that we were one of the lucky ones in the area. There was a lot of folks that lost in the 30, 40, 50, and all the way up to 80 or 90% of their herds were complete losses.
And that adds up, according to the Washington Post, to about $3.7 billion in economic activity lost. Would you expect that the federal government would provide $3.7 billion in compensation here? Anything close to that?
No. That's not a good number to look at. The economic loss, you can run those numbers in a lot of different directions. And basically what we're trying to accomplish, what do we hope it will be accomplished by the Farm Bill, if it gets passed in its current form with the Livestock Indemnity Program in place, all we're looking for is the ability for those folks to stay in business, get back in business and stay in business so that they've got some income so they can stay on the ranch in coming years.
And the Senate's been up all night for the past two nights. You got to wonder what the heck they're doing if they're not dealing with your emergency here. Have you had any thoughts about, you know, forgetting the ranching business and moving up into North Dakota and getting into the oil business?
Well, it looks the oil business looks fairly attractive if you've got the mineral rights, but it's one of those deals where when you're in the ranching business, you develop some roots that are fairly deep. I had the privilege of knowing all four of my great-grandfathers, three of them homesteaded right in this area. So
wow.
Most ranch families, the roots run fairly deep.
Well, Gary Kamak, good luck to you. I hate to bet on what's going on Capitol Hill, but you have no choice. Gary Kamak is a South Dakota representative for District 29, representing Butte, Meade, and Pennington counties, and has 100 cows and calves lost in a storm that he's waiting for the Farm Bill to compensate him for. Gary, thanks so much.
Thank you.
While ranchers and other people around the country, including food stamp recipients, wait for the passage of the Farm Bill, there's a bigger story in Washington. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Welcome to the program.
Hi, John.
Todd, I think I may be dreaming. You want to listen to something here?
Sure.
This is House Speaker John Boehner.
They pushed us into this fight to defund Obamacare and to shut down the government. Most of you know, my members know, that wasn't exactly the strategy that I had in mind. But if you'll recall, the day before the government reopened, one of these groups stood up and said, well, we never really thought it would work. Are you kidding me?
Is that John Boehner turning on the Tea Party? Am I dreaming?
No, that's exactly what it is now. Let's parse a little bit. John Boehner not turning on the Tea Party per se. This is an inside Washington story with big implications. John Boehner turning on Tea Party and conservative affiliated groups, big money groups that give money to conservatives who primary, who challenge Republicans, give money, make commercials, attack them, monitor their votes. That's who he's going against. He's tired of it. In the last couple days, John, he's been not only ranting into microphones to reporters, but going in conference with his fellow Republicans and giving much the same speech, saying, tell these guys finally to back off.
And the gloves are really off. Listen to this.
I think they're misleading their followers. I think they're pushing our members in places where they don't want to be. And frankly, I just think that they've lost all credibility.
Now, have they lost all credibility before or after John Boehner, as Speaker of the House, has lost all credibility in his ability to actually control his caucus? He feels a little late to the game here, Todd. What's the epiphany?
That's the question of whether this newfound indignation with these groups is going to do John Boehner any good going forward here. Look, he's talking about groups like Freedom Works, Heritage Action, the Senate Conservative Fund. There are others. Some of those names might be familiar to people outside the Beltway, but they've got millions of dollars backed by some big, big, powerful conservative forces. Look, I talked to a bunch of Boehner's people after this happened because you think, look, he's a professional. He's been in this business 30 years. He doesn't lose his temper like that. There's lots of ways to vent. This must have been strategic. And they say, no, we didn't know it was coming, but this is 3 years in the making. It wasn't just their urging conservatives to vote against this Ryan Murray budget deal that passed yesterday in the House. It wasn't just that. It was 3 years in the making. They said, look, they opposed the Budget Control Act. They opposed the Super Committee. They cornered us on the shutdown. They cornered us on Obamacare, and the boss is sick of it. And he wants to gain some control going forward. Now, look, it's not all just rhetoric. Do you want a good example of the fact that a lot of House members agree with John Boehner on this? Look at the vote on the Ryan Murray budget plan that those very conservative groups, John, opposed yesterday. They said, hey, conservatives, you're going to lose your rating with us if you vote for this. You might lose some money if you vote for this. Do you know that 169 Republicans voted with Boehner, not with the conservative groups? He showed them with numbers, not just with words.
So the Senate has been working all night for the last two nights. Have they just been dealing with Senate-only appointments, or do they believe that the House is going to actually follow through on some bills that are coming from the Senate?
Well, everything's backed up. What's been going on with this Senate working through the night, John, I'm sorry to say, is not a whole great deal of substance. It's a whole lot of internecine Senate bickering and fighting. This is a post-nuclear option battle between Mitch McConnell and Harry Reid. When Harry Reid invoked the nuclear option and they said, hey, no more filibusters on administration nominees except the Supreme Court, Mitch McConnell said, you're going to regret this. And now Republicans are using all of the time available to them under the rules, even though there's no filibuster, to delay every single nominee that's on the calendar. Democrats are responding in their own sort of procedural arm race. And what are they doing? They're going all night long, giving speeches to empty chambers, voting in the middle of the night to clear some judicial but also some more mundane administration nominees. Now, there's some substance backed up behind this. You just talked to Mr. Kamak about the farm bill. There's an extension of the farm bill for 3 months, which has been passed by the House, that's backed up behind the Senate fight that they were going to try to pass before this is all over. Turns out Harry Reid's not going to pass that. The farm bill's not going to be extended. But there's also the defense authorization. There's the Murray Ryan budget plan that has to be passed before people go home. And it's all backed up behind this stuff. And they could be in session 24 hours a day, voting in the middle of the night and in the middle of the day until Saturday night, John.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, on a change of scene, a change of the winds, certainly, among conservatives in the House of Representatives. John Boehner has a very different view of the Tea Party, and of course they're going all-nighters in the Senate. Todd, thanks so much. Have a great weekend.
You bet. You too, John.
This hour by considering a simple request from some parents still grieving a year after a loss, still difficult to comprehend.
We know that many people across the country will be thinking of our children and educators, so tragically taken from us, and wondering how to help. We ask that you consider performing an act of kindness or volunteering with a charitable organization in your own local community.
A call for kindness there from Joanne Bacon, mother of a murdered first grader from Newtown, Connecticut, reading a statement from the family victims of the Newtown tragedy. Kindness in remembrance of what happened to them a year ago tomorrow. What does that mean, we wondered, a call for kindness? What does it mean for them, for us? It means something to many of you out there.
Many years ago, in an unexpected act of kindness, a friend, someone I really didn't know very well, pulled me out of a woman's shelter with my child and got me into college and on track. I was told to pay it forward, and years later I did so. I am now the parent of 13 children, all who have gone off to college. I pulled children out of foster care and improved their lives, since my life was so dramatically improved at a very delicate moment in my own life.
This is Judy from Boston. When all at once I was diagnosed with lung cancer, close to bankruptcy, divorcing, becoming a single mom, and caring for elderly parents, many friends and acquaintances provided acts and words of kindness. Sometimes, even just kind and caring words can be an act of kindness that can give one hope and help you to turn a corner.
Thanks to those listeners there. We'd love to hear stories from more of you as well at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can post a comment at thetakeaway.org. Now, certainly no one would argue that more kindness in the world is welcome. It's needed, gratefully encouraged. But what of this impulse from grieving parents to ask for something from all of us, something they feel they need, reaching out 1 year after the killings in Newtown, Connecticut, to be heard? Joining us now, Colin Goddard survived the 2007 Virginia Tech shooting. Colin, welcome.
Great to be with you.
And Megan Sullivan lost her brother Alex in the 2012 Aurora, Colorado movie theater shooting. Megan, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Can both of you think back a year after the tragedy that happened to you? In your case, Megan, it's much closer than for you, Colin. And understand this impulse of the Newtown parents to reach out to all of us, to ask us to do this simple thing. Megan?
Yeah, I think, you know, I remember just after the amount of cards from, you know, longtime friends or just acquaintances to complete strangers, the cards that, you know, my family received, and how just those alone got us through those really hard nights right at the very beginning. And, you know, then when the anniversary came, you know, me and my parents sat down again, read through those cards, and just those kind words and, you know, sense of comfort, you know, from so many people was so welcome and really nice to be able to look back at that.
Colin Goddard, what do you make of this impulse to reach out, to get somebody to remember, to help, to mobilize people on some level?
I mean, it's a desire the families have to know that they're not alone, you know, to know that there are people out there who are thinking about them. It's an incredible experience when you receive a very heartwritten letter from somebody across the country that you've never met before, talking about, you know, how wonderful your child was, or, you know, how, you know, the experience moved them. And so, you know, having that support from your direct friends and family is critical. And then when it comes from random strangers, from people who you never met before, who have gone above and beyond, it really helps, I think, get you to that next day.
A year after the Virginia Tech shooting, did you want to do something, want to reach out to help people to remember what had happened to you, that you hadn't moved on, even though most of the rest of the country had?
Well, I was in my last year of college. We actually had a long day of events, a variety of events that happened on campus, different ways to express, you know, how you're feeling, you know, candlelight vigils, you know, memorial services. And I had, you know, I know that I had met others from other school shootings since then and before then, and they came to Blacksburg to be with us on this day, and it really meant a lot to the people who were there to know that, you know, like I said, there were others who had similar experiences and have your back and are going to be with you, and it was very nice.
Megan, of course, for you, there's nothing that can bring your brother Alex back. How's all that going for you right now?
I think, you know, it's still an everyday process, you know, especially with the holidays coming up. You know, a lot of my memories are, you know, holiday memories are, you know, the four of us, my parents and me and my brother. And, you know, it's hard to kind of move on from there, but, you know, remember at the same time. And, you know, it's creating new memories and creating, you know, a special place for him in, you know, the present moment. And, but also, you know, finding Alex in other people, I think that's what's brought me the most comfort.
So even though kindness might have done nothing to prevent the shooter in Aurora or at Virginia Tech or even up in Newtown from doing what they did, you, Megan, are really, you're on board with this impulse from these families. They're really on to something here, as far as you can tell.
Yeah, I mean, it was when I read the news about, you know, what they wanted, it rung very true for me, and being able to, you know, understand that at the end of the day, like, love and kindness and community wins out above all others, and that it will continue to do that as long as we work on it, because it's not something that comes easy. It's a lot easier to, you know, hold hate close to your heart and, you know, anger. It's a lot easier to do that, but if you kind of work towards, you know, love and, you know, compassion for others, you know, at the end of the day, it's going to move you further.
Do you believe that, Colin?
Yeah, absolutely. Something actually very similar happened at Virginia Tech after the shooting. The psychology professor, Dr. Geller, and several of his students came together and started what was called Actively Caring for People, which was a very simple premise of creating those rubber wristbands that you see often made for a variety of things that said Actively Caring for People. And they gave them out to us and many people on campus as possible, and said, when you see somebody out in your life, do an act of kindness for somebody else. Give them this wristband. Tell them why you're giving it to them and ask them to pay it forward. And, you know, just, you know, acknowledging, you know, when someone gets up out of their bus seat for an older woman, you know, that's when I gave my wristband away and I told them why. And I said, look, you know, can you please pass this on in your own way? And it's very cool to see those wristbands now come back around, and I've seen them on other people years later. And, you know, how one act of kindness can spread so far is incredible. And I think it does mean even the smallest effort can mean a great deal to somebody.
Our thanks to Colin Goddard, who survived the 2007 Virginia Tech shooting, and also Megan Sullivan, who lost her brother Alex in the 2012 Aurora, Colorado movie theater shooting. Share your stories at 877-8-MY-TECH or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.